Drum technique. Drum technique.
Hey, we're here with the Drum Technique Live. Our very first episode on a whim. We have Joseph Leonidas Henley with us today. How you doing, Joe?
I'm doing well.
Joe, you're kind of a multifaceted guy. Cage fighter, you're a wrestling coach, football coach. What else are you? You're a substitute teacher sometimes, and now you're a tech guy.
I am a tech specialist now.
I don't believe that.
I wouldn't either.
If you walked in to fix my computer, I'm pretty sure I'd get a second opinion immediately. I don't know why that is. Why is it that sometimes we like gravitate these kind of body types or facial expressions towards professions? You know what I mean?
Well, you know, I mean, it's a little bit of everything. You got the beard, the hair, the preconceived notion that I already hit people in the face. So the fact that you just wouldn't expect me to come in and tell you how to fix your computer.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's proper or not, but I might ask, you know, for security to come. I'd be like, some guy is definitely...
I wouldn't even blame you. I would walk across the street if I saw me walking down the street. I'd be like, nah, I'm just not going to give that guy a chance.
But going into your career as a fighter, what was it about MMA that kind of brought you in? Like, were you always into martial arts as a kid growing up? I mean, me growing up, I gravitated towards kung fu movies. Loved Bruce Lee. I wanted to be a ninja, you know? That was basically what it was for me. And so did you have that growing up?
I did. I was a big taekwondo guy. I got into taekwondo really young, really got into it, really, really loved the different aspects of it. And then, you know, you gravitate towards your favorite mixed martial arts movie, your martial arts movie. For me, it was Bloodsport.
Yeah.
With Van Damme.
Oh,
and you
yeah.
had all the difference. You know, you had the sumo, you had the guy from Africa, you had, you know, the tiger claw guys, you know, you had the Muay Thai guys. And so it was one of those things where that was like a defining movie for me that was like, dude, I have to be like that.
Yeah, and that monkey kung fu guy was really the best.
Yeah.
That was it. I have no idea why I was so disappointed when that sumo wrestler broke his back.
Yeah, that was pretty disappointing.
It was
like a bear hug. Here, come here. Let me squeeze you, little guy. That was it. You were like,
That killed me. But that was reality. That was like one of the parts that, you know, you're like, wow, you know, strength does overcome technique sometimes.
Every now and then.
Especially when you're acting like a monkey.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So you were into taekwondo and then you started wrestling in high school, or how'd that work out?
Yeah. So I mean, I've done everything under the sun in terms of athletics, football, wrestling, tennis, golf. You know, you name it, I've played it. But when I got to high school, I had kind of just burnt out. I mean, everybody has a time limit or a shelf life in terms of how long your attention span lasts, especially as a kid. And so as we got with the taekwondo, I got my black belt, and then it was kind of like, I've been doing this for like 5 or 6 years. Okay. You know, especially at that age, you know, you want to branch out, you want to try new things. So that's when I got to high school, and I was kind of a fat kid. Not fat, but I was chubby. You know, I was the chubby friend for most of my life. And so then I started wrestling and started really, really enjoying the grappling aspect of it, and played other sports, played football, and ended up going to college to play football. But yeah, that's kind of how it all started, was more or less just getting in there and just really loving that aspect of competition.
How long did it take you to get your black belt in taekwondo?
I think like 5 years.
Wow.
5 or 6 years.
And this was at a pretty early age, right?
Yeah, I think I had my black belt by the time I was 12.
12 years old?
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's one of those things where people look at that and they go, oh, a 12-year-old black belt. Well, it's more techniques. It's more understanding. It's discipline. It's, you know, putting in your time and doing things like that. As where things with like jiu-jitsu, it's more, you know, putting technique into practice. So,
you know, I hear that, and I've never taken taekwondo, so I'm not sure if this is correct or not, but I've heard that, you know, getting your black belt in taekwondo is kind of like the starting point. You know, it's like you know a good foundation, and now you transfer on to kind of becoming an expert after the fact.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that goes along almost with any martial arts. I mean, something that, you know, even black belts in jiu-jitsu, you know, Fabio Leopoldo and Eric Klinger at Gracie Morumbi have told me in the past, and they actually preach a lot, is that, you know, once you get to black belt, it's like starting anew. You know, a lot of people feel like they learn so much and they become black belts and you feel like you're a master. But then when you actually are a black belt, you realize how little you know and how much more there is to still learn.
Yeah.
And so it's like starting over again. And I think that's that almost runs across the board with all martial arts. I think everybody, you know, as you're young, you're brand new, you're the white belt. Everything, you know, you don't understand the small intricacies of things that you're doing, but you get the basic concepts. And then by the time you've put in enough time to be a black belt, now you understand all of the basic concepts. Now it's time to go back, revisit, and find all the little intricacies of how you should be doing things better.
Yeah, the nuances, right? Becoming, like they say with BJ Penn and whatnot, like the advanced basics.
Yeah.
You know, just finding those small, minute details that really clamp down and take your game to the next level. You know, I wouldn't know anything about that. Like, I'm still a blue belt, you know. I roll with brown belts, and I can't imagine even getting to their level at this point. You know what I mean? But I'm only a couple years into the game. I grew up, you know, taking a different approach. I started out trying to do kung fu, you know, because I love Bruce Lee. And then, you know, from then, you know, I watched the UFC and whatnot, too. And it turned out like, you know, the kung fu masters weren't winning. And there was no jiu-jitsu schools next to me, though. I grew up in El Paso, Texas. So, you know, after a while with the UFCs, and I'm sure you realize that too, you know, by the time, you know, UFC 8, 9 rolled around, you know, the strong wrestlers started taking over, and you started getting the Mark Colemans, you started getting, you know, Mark Kerr, even guys like Tank Abbott, you know, started to come around. And I almost started kind of losing my interest because, you know, I wasn't seeing this, like, beautiful, you know, flowery techniques, you know, just advocating on people, just, you know, really dominating the sport anymore. And but I did still see it in kind of in boxing. You know, I could watch, you know, Pernell Whitaker, I could watch Roy Jones Jr., you know, and I could watch their technique, and it almost looked like a movie. You know, you'd see Roy Jones Jr. talking to Larry Merchant while fighting the guy, and I was like, this is incredible, you know, knocking somebody out with their hands behind their back. So I ended up gravitating towards that way, and then came back into, you know, jiu-jitsu and things later on. But you know, I developed my appreciation, you know, for seeing like what you're saying right now with jiu-jitsu, you know, much later on. It took a few years, you know, for me to come back around to the grappling game, but it is incredible, you know.
You know, to me, it's one of those things like boxing. Boxing's amazing, but when you see the highest level boxers, I mean, these guys have been doing it their entire lives, you know? I mean, they've been working on these techniques since, you know, they were 4 or 5. And so by the time they're 22, 25, I mean, they've got those things down. And so it's so much more of a beautiful thing to watch, as where, especially with UFC, even right now, MMA in general, you see a lot of guys that got into it maybe 5 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, when they were 20, and or maybe they were 25 and they just got in. You know, that was when I actually got into the sport, was right around 24, 25.
Which would be extremely late for boxers.
Yeah. Which wouldn't even happen for boxers. I'd be like, you can't pick everything else up. But with mixed martial arts, there's such a variety of different ways to be good. And I think what's happening now is we're really starting to see the best of us really rise to the top. I mean, you look at the middleweight division in the UFC right now.
Oh, it's incredible.
I mean, really the top 5 guys almost feel untouchable unless they're fighting each other. Like watching Musasi just destroy Costas, who is a good fighter. He's a very good fighter.
He's an amazing fighter, yeah.
But he's not a top 5 fighter. He's not one of the best in the world. He's, you know, he's a very good fighter. And so when you watch, especially on the ground, I mean, Musasi just schooled him. There was nothing to be had on the ground for Costas. And so it's, you know, I feel like, you know, watching that fight, that was a fun fight to watch because of Musasi's technique. But you watched a lot of the undercards, and you still see the guys that just swing for the fences. There's no, you know, not really necessarily technique. Yeah, they may be good at swinging for the fences, but that's all you still get. And it still feels like it's rudimentary. Yeah. And so when you watch it and you go, ah, God, I'm like, you know, a lot of people have that bloodlust, that, oh, my God, I want to see somebody get knocked out.
Yeah.
And for me, I'm not as big of a fan of that. There was a really bloody fight. I can't remember who was fighting. There were 2 kids in this last UFC. And they were, I mean, it was a very entertaining fight. But when you watched it, you know, you standing, you were kind of like, meh. You know, if one of you was that much better than the other one, somebody'd be getting schooled right now.
Yeah.
So like in the Costas fight.
And there's still, even, you know, speaking of Gegard Mousasi, there's still even like an upper echelon even there. I mean, you watch the Jacare fight with him. Wow. Yeah. I was so impressed with Jacare. I mean, not only is, you know, his ground game, you know, probably above and beyond everybody. I mean, it would take like a Weidman maybe to neutralize someone like Jacare. And that's the matchup I actually wanted to see most going in, you know, to the last set of big fights that they had. I understand like Luke Rockhold, you know, stole the show after that performance against Machida, and now everybody wants Rockhold, you know, versus Weidman. But, you know, to me, I still want Jacare because I think he has stylistically maybe the best chance to beat him, you know?
And to be honest, I mean, I still think it'll happen. But I actually, Luke Rockhold's one of my favorite fighters to watch.
Oh, he's amazing.
Right now. Just because of his fluidity, his technique, from standing to the ground, everything is more than solid.
It's extremely handsome.
It's expert level. Now, that was a little weird, but I'm going to tell you. But he's fun to watch. And so, like, for me, I think that's a problem, unfortunately, for Chris Weidman. He's really not that fun to watch. Yeah. He's very, very good. But he's not necessarily bringing anything dynamic. He's just a phenomenal wrestler that will throw punches. Yeah. And he's a phenomenal jiu-jitsu. You know what I mean? His skill level on the ground is out of this world. But there's nothing where you're like, oh my God. It was like, yeah, that was cool. I've heard different spots where, you know, he doesn't understand why, you know, the American fans don't get behind him. You know, like Brazil fans get behind the Brazilian guys.
Yeah.
And I kind of understand that, and it, you know, you feel kind of bad for him. And it's, you know, I'm obviously American, and I would love, you know,
dude, that's a product with all American fighters, right?
I mean,
look at the Pacquiao Mayweather fight. Nobody was rooting for Mayweather.
No, well, he's kind of an asshole. So
yeah,
which I mean, you know, but you know, even in that fight, you know, what a lot of people don't understand is that this is still an entertainment business. This is not just, you know, scrapping. People have to want to buy your pay per views. They have to want to watch you fight.
Yeah.
And, you know, look at the flyweight division, you know, poor Mighty Mouse.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, he's really exciting. And technically he's amazing. For me, I will watch that guy fight anytime.
Yeah.
But he's 125 pounds. And you tell anybody, for the most part, I mean, look at the, you know, even the weight classes in boxing, anything under 140, I mean, most people couldn't even name a boxer that fights under 140.
It's hard. I mean, I think just humans in general have this, you know, This thing that they want to see the best fighter or who's the baddest man on the planet. It's always easy to say when Mike Tyson was around, you know? And, you know, for the most part, I think that's why people have gravitated, you know, towards heavyweights. But, you know, there's always been these times in history where, you know, a lighter fighter steals the show. I mean, you know, when Ali and, you know, all those guys left the table, you know, Sugar Ray Leonard's and Duran's and, you know, Hagler's took over. And then, you know, there was an emergence of Tyson and whatnot, but it kind of, you're right, it shifts back and forth between guys who, you know, are either so technically proficient, but you can still appreciate that this guy might be able to whip your ass, or they just, you know, who would win no matter what? Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, who would win no matter what? You know?
But it's weird. It gets to a point where there's some weight class where you're just like, 35s is garnered much more respect, 45s. Even at 145 pounds, and I think because most people realize if you're a 145 pounder, you probably weigh about 160.
Yeah, you're an average size guy.
Yeah, so I think that still feels average. But when you say 125, I mean, I rarely have a girlfriend that weighs under 125.
Wow.
You know, and that's not even, you know, chubby chasing. That's just normal girls, you know, are that big. So when you say 125 pounder, a lot of people look at that guy like, yeah, but dude, you're only 125 pounds, maybe 140.
Yeah.
I'd be like, you're so cute at 5'2".
No, I agree.
And you know, you feel bad because those guys can still kick your ass.
I mean,
Chris Beal at 125 pounds, who walks around more closer to 155, 160,
yeah,
is a monster.
I saw him the other day.
And he's gladly bloodied my face on multiple occasions. But, you know, when the average fan hears it, they still kind of go, I don't know.
Yeah.
So...
yeah, there's a perception that, you know, shit at the fin, yeah, I'd probably beat him up.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Which is strange, but it is just a natural thing, though, to want to kind of gravitate, you know, to see the actual, you know, the best, or to see who could beat everyone. You know what I mean? I think that is, you know, the case with most things. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you see a tennis player or whatever, you know, you want to know who's the number one guy, who could beat everybody else if they put him on the court, you know, and... you know, I get it, you know, I truly get it. And, you know, but as fact as the Mayweather thing, you know, I think most people, you know, came away from that, you know, well, granted, the most people who watch that fight don't watch boxing.
No.
You know what I mean? Like, I think it's fair to say that. Like,
yeah,
everyone who went crazy after that fight, being like, this is the most horrible thing I've ever seen and, you know, whatnot. I mean, those people are the same people who pretend to like soccer during the World Cup. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're not, their opinion doesn't really matter to the sport in the long run, but they're the most vocal advocates, you know, right after something like that happens, yeah. You know, which is unfortunate because that was a beautiful display by Mayweather. I mean, I've never seen Manny Pacquiao within like what the last 8 years be shut down like that.
Well, even, I mean, he had, what, there was at least three, maybe four rounds where he landed three punches.
Yeah.
I'm like, you had 9 minutes and you landed three punches.
Yeah.
Like, to me, that's more a credit to Mayweather.
Yeah.
I'm like, cause I mean, three punches a round. I mean, it, you think about it. You're like, give me 3 minutes. I feel like I can hit you more than three times. But yeah. That was the other, you know, one of the other best fighters on the planet, and he couldn't do it.
And yeah. The guy that, you know, most people like thought was the one. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, this is finally the guy that we've been talking about for 5 years who's going to shut this guy up. You know, he was finally the one that everyone had put their hopes and dreams on. And, you know, during failed negotiations would always side with Manny, whether, you know, he doesn't want to take a steroid test. Why would Mayweather ask for a steroid test? That's insane. That he shouldn't ask for that. You know, that's something the commission should handle. It's like, we're talking about a fair fight here, people. Yeah. Like, is it really bad that he's asking for a steroid test? But, you know, people hated Mayweather so bad that Manny could do that. He could refuse a steroid test and people would still side with him. Yeah. Like, it really didn't matter.
Well, another amazing thing, just, you know, people in general, when you're talking about fighting, I mean, Manny could do no wrong and Mayweather could do no right.
Yeah.
You know, and it was amazing how, I mean, we're talking about a boxing fight, but people want to dive into personal lives. And every single personal thing that Floyd did in his life. Oh, he's a terrible person. Oh, he's a, I don't care. I'm watching boxing. I just want to watch these two box.
That was interesting, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, the minute that fight was over, I remember seeing one of the most circulated Twitter posts going on was like, if you bought this Mayweather fight, you are supporting domestic abuse and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then it came out something about Manny as well. Like, I mean, they were digging up all this personal, you know, info, which isn't, you know, you don't see that a lot in other things. I mean, sometimes you see it like an NFL, like with the Ray Rice situation or whatnot. But I mean, look, we've seen worse. Like, we've seen situations like Chris Brown, right? And you actually get a mugshot of one of the most famous, you know, pop artists, you know, R&B, whatever, in America with Rihanna, with a lumped up face. And that guy's making hits right now.
Yeah.
And no one's really, you know, being like, I don't like this song because of this guy. You know, like, people are able to separate basically the art from the individual in a lot of other, you know, areas of life. But with boxing, like, you know, I don't know if it's just the main events or whatever, but like, that was what people were trying to focus on after this fight. You know what I mean? And that's just, I mean, I think that has to do a lot with the fact that, you know, this was a general public watching that doesn't watch combat sports.
Yeah.
They have no appreciation for what Mayweather is able to do in the ring. You know, they weren't looking at this guy and saying, my God, Manny Pacquiao normally can get off 5, 6, 7 punch combinations and Mayweather just boom, he's just jailbreaking these within the first two punches. You know what I mean? Like, they weren't looking at that. How is he able to control the range? How is he able to slip out of these things so effortlessly? You know, no care whatsoever. They're like, I think this guy's hugging and I want him to lose. And,
what?
You know,
that was another,
and
that
he
was,
beats
that,
women.
That was another huge thing for me where everybody, oh, he's hugging him all the time. Oh, he's hugging him all the time. I'm like, have you ever watched a boxing fight?
Yeah.
Boxing fights take three people. You have to have a referee in there because they hug each other a lot. It happens. The range gets too close. And unless you're Triple G in that fight, which was amazing, by the way, where you just had two guys that were willing to put their face, you know, head to head, forehead to forehead and swing at each other. But if you got guys that are not willing to do that, like, you know, a lot, even with Pacquiao, so often his feet left him. And as he's throwing his combination, he's getting closer and closer. You know, it's, yeah, okay, you both got so close that you eventually end up in that position. And then the referee separates you. And that happens in a lot of boxing fights. It's not all that uncommon, in my opinion. So yeah. I thought Floyd fought most of the fight at a good range.
He fights at the perfect range. Yeah. I mean, that is what makes Floyd Mayweather so incredible, is his ability to constantly control the range. I mean, Manny Pacquiao, he's been amazing, you know, and I don't want to pigeonhole him here because he is an amazing fighter, but he's been amazing mostly against flat-footed fighters. Mm-hmm. When you see him fight a Margarito or someone who's walking straight forward at him, you know, he's able to kind of dart in, you know, start up his three-punch combination, and he usually bolts left, bolts right, you know, but he finds an angle off in which he lands 5, 6, 7, 8 punches, you know, and he throws them from different angles, and he throws them from awkward angles, and you know, even that shot, that mixed up Kodo. I mean, that was a vintage Prince Nassim Hamad, you know, angled uppercut. You know, you never see that thrown really effectively, you know, from too many fighters. But, you know, this guy fights off his legs. It's amazing to watch. But Mayweather can literally, you know, like a video game, just throw a combo breaker in there, either by taking a step back or just the, you know, pop shotting beautifully with his right hand, or
those were mean.
Yeah, or slipping out with a check left hook, or, you know, whatever he's doing. It's amazing, you know, and you would have to understand how good they are to appreciate what was taking place. And if you didn't understand at that kind of level, then it's no better than the guys who watch, you know, UFC, and as soon as it hits the ground, they're like, stand him up, you know, stand him up immediately. You know, you get that every fight still.
Yeah.
You know, the crowd is, I think, becoming more educated. I mean, it's obviously gone up since like 2006.
Yeah.
2006 was horrible. Like, that was like probably the worst. That was like right after The Ultimate Fighter. You know, you had Forrest Griffin and Stephen Bonner just smacking each other in the middle of the ring, and people loved it, you know, they ate it up. But there was a time period after there where any kind of significant grappling that took place, people were... they're upset.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They were visibly upset. And, you know, nowadays you are seeing a more of appreciation, but that still exists, you know?
Well, you know, I think it's also part of jiu-jitsu evolving in the fight game, where it, you know, it used to be setting traps and taking a bit more time. And then, you know, nowadays it's a much more aggressive, a much more fast paced ground game. Even if you're looking to control ground and pound, even in the scrambles, a lot of things have changed. And so you have guys like Jacare that are very aggressive on the ground. They don't wait for you to fall into a trap. They guide you into the trap physically, you know, whether that be with punches or positioning. And so the jiu-jitsu is more gone from, you know, where people think, jiu-jitsu, the guy that lays on his back, to where you're getting the guys that are on top of you and maneuvering that way and looking for arm triangles and looking for arm bars and are very slick, you know, especially like Mighty Mouse's arm bar. And that last fight, it was beautiful.
Yeah.
And, you know, he got that because of his aggression on top and the way that, you know, it's not a, you know, like, you know, jiu-jitsu originally more for defense, more to for the small guy to defend himself against the big guy. Well, now it's for any guy to get, you know, after anybody and be aggressive. It's not so much more self-defense. It's more about that aggression. And that's fun to watch, because people can then, you know, as they see somebody moving forward, or they're going for chokes, or they're going for arm, you know, everybody kind of understands, you know, ow, that hurts. You know, that looks painful. And the more you get to see it, the more exciting people can get after it.
Yeah, I mean, the game has changed, you know, a lot. And, you know, a lot of that has to do in terms of the rules and whatnot and rounds and whatnot. I mean, back in the day, you'd always hear, you know, Hoyce Gracie talking about, I'm going to cook this guy. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to set him up and I'm going to wear him out. And you know, I guess this fight with Dan Severn would be possibly the best example of that. You know, you had this huge monster of a man, you know, just riding him for 20 straight minutes, you know, and, you know, the very end, boom, you know, he slaps on the kill shot. Yep. You know what I mean? And there is no cooking, you know, for jiu-jitsu. I mean, and that is a part of the art. I mean, that is the art of the jiu-jitsu. A lot of it, you know, is to find, you know, safety, you know, to be able to protect yourself. You know, the Gracie brothers are always saying, you know, defense first.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, you know, and I think it's a good thing, because it's making markets for both sides of jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
You know, you've got your no-gi market and you've got your gi market. And you know, I love it when people say, oh, you know, to get really good at jiu-jitsu, you got to put the gi on. I'm like, I don't necessarily agree with that.
Is that right?
Yeah, a lot of people feel like that, like if you really want to get to the upper echelon, because look at all the upper echelon fighters. They all, you know, anybody that used to be...
Most of them were
started in the gi. And so everybody feels like that's going to be it. Now you guys, you know, you have guys that now are starting no-gi that have never put on a gi before and are able to get their level up there. And I think it'll change. I mean, we're just still such a new sport to me.
That's really interesting.
20 years old, maybe, you know? Yeah. So, I mean, we've still got so much evolving, and so many of the fighters started somewhere else. You know, you have, you know, even football, think football. A kid has played football since he was 8, 7.
Yeah.
You know, to get to the NFL most of the time. Rarely do you, I mean, you couldn't, you actually can't. You can't just get a guy outside of a, you know, just a, you know, a superstar like Antonio Gates, guys that I don't know. Did he even ever play football? I don't even know if he played football in high school. I know, you know, he's a basketball guy in college, and then was like, I think I'll play tight end.
Yeah. Super athlete.
Yeah. You're always going to have a couple of super athletes, but with MMA, it's everybody. Yeah. Nobody just started doing MMA. I mean, I think Rory McDonald might have been one of the early, you know, where he started as a, you know, a teenager. But
that's coming.
It's coming because we now have all the kids' classes. You know, the kids are doing no-gi MMA, you know, at, you know, this level. And, you know, pray to God they get with a good academy where they keep them in check. You know, heaven forbid you get these kids that are just learning to beat people up.
Right.
Which is not, but that's, and to me, that's what I like traditional jiu-jitsu schools getting into that aspect of it, because the tradition comes with so much discipline. And so you have instructors that are discipline based now teaching, you know, more aggression, but are still able to install the discipline of this is not to be used.
Yeah, good values.
Know, yeah, you know what I mean? And you really have to have that base. And I think it gets a little, you get a little frightened when people are just go no-gi because, you know, it hasn't been around for very long. So, you know, they don't have that background, that tradition, you know, they're just building it. And so you're always wary about things like
that. There's a lot of resistance, you know, for that movement. There's a ton of resistance. We don't really necessarily have to get into it. But, you know, I always found it fascinating because, you know, that you have that perspective because you are a brown belt under, you know, a world champion, Fabio Leopoldo. You know, I always hear, you know, the gi and its ability to slow things down and its ability to, you know, your chokes are almost unlimited. You know, once you have, you know, fabric to put around people and, you know, the options to submitting somebody, you know, there's so much more that it makes you think.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I always heard that was like the main argument for why if you train in the gi, you'll be better at no gi just because you'll think more. And I don't necessarily know if that's true. You know what I mean? I'll tell you what, I have trained at Eddie Bravo's 10th Planet Jiu-Jitsu for like the last month or two, you know, so, and before that I'd only primarily trained in the gi and I'm getting whooped, you know, and I'm getting whooped, you know, because a lot of my base and approach I can't use anymore. You know, a lot of my open guard game I'm doing with collar control. Mm. A lot of my attacks from top half guard position, you know, would be things like Ezekiel's and stuff, which I can't use it anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it's done. So,
you know, it's one of those things, I think it depends on your gi instructor.
Yeah.
You know, I was very, very lucky to have Fabio Leopoldo land in Ventura, California, because his gi game is still very no-gi based almost. It's very no-gi stylistically. A lot of the things that he'll do, you can transition to the no-gi game. And so, you know, as he's teaching us these things and as we learned a lot of the basics and, you know, you still learn the handle and grips and things like that, but so much of it was still applicable to be able to fight. And I was also in a strange position because I started fighting before I started doing jiu-jitsu.
Is that right?
Yeah, I started doing no-gi. Well, I started doing no-gi jiu-jitsu because I had wrestled and I had gained a lot of, after college, I gained a lot of weight. I was like 270. And Brian Peterson, who's actually the coach at Big John McCarthy's Ultimate Training Academy, which is a phenomenal school in Valencia, California, was my first jiu-jitsu instructor. And we started learning and I was amazed. He's a little itty bitty guy. He's maybe 130 pounds, maybe. And I've never, you know, I have now, but at the time I'd never been dominated by somebody so small and had them feel so heavy. It blew my mind. And you know, so I started learning, you know, no-gi jiu-jitsu. And because I had been a wrestler, it kind of transitioned well, but I had to take a lot of time. And I remember the first 6 months of training, I remember because I felt so uncomfortable on my back that I was like, all right, well, I'm just going to fall to my back every single time and we're just going to figure this out.
Wow.
And it's funny because that's actually where I feel more comfortable even now. Even with the wrestling base, I still just feel more dangerous off my back when it comes to sweeps. Now, finishing, I feel more dangerous on top. But I feel like, especially for a mixed martial arts game, I like to be able to sweep and create scrambles from the bottom. That's my style. That's what I like. I don't like to look for arm bars or triangles or, you know, these things. I like to set the sweep up and I like to create the movement. And so I feel like my game is going to be much different than other people's in terms of off your back. But a lot of that came from Fabio. Fabio showing me some phenomenal sweeps in the gi that were easy to transition to no gi. And so I've been able to keep practicing a lot of the things that I learned in a gi class in when I was going down to train with Mark Munoz in the Rain Training Center when that was still going. And so it was a nice, easy transition for my game, you know, gi to no gi. But it depends. If you get an instructor who's so very, very adamant about, you know, lapel control and, you know, these different things and never really explains how they can transition, I could see how going from one to the other, you feel lost without something to hold on to.
Yeah. Yeah. it is definitely, it's been a new process for me, but you know, it, you know, I guess that's how it goes.
You know what, the way to learn is to get your butt kicked. I was at Dos Pueblos High School, visiting with some special needs kids, a great group of kids. And I actually know the wrestling coach, Anthony Calfano. And we wandered over just to go say, you know, hi to the kids. And they were talking to me, and I had one kid come out and asked me, he said, you know, I'm really fighting. He said, but you said, you know, this is not really a great way to make money. I was like, no, unless you're in the UFC, those are the only people really making money. But he said, you know, well, I'm at this gym right now and they're all big guys, you know, and that's all I get. And I'm like, well, that's probably not a good idea. You know, you're a little guy. Yeah, there's a lot of things you can learn, but you know, you need to find guys your size. But not only that, you can't be the best person in your gym.
Yeah.
If you're the best person in your gym, you're at the wrong gym.
You need to go somewhere else.
As far as the competition goes.
Right.
You know, now if you just are just happy-go-lucky and you just like doing that, and you know, which is great. There's a lot of guys like that. And if you're technically the best person there, enjoy. You know, because then you become more of a teacher than a learner. Right. And even then, when you're teaching, you're still learning.
You're learning, correct.
So, but, you know, if you're really wanting to compete, you know, you can't always be teaching. You need to be learning, you know, heavier on that. And so I say, you know, and that's part of the reason why I always seem to bounce around from gym to gym until I hit Rain, because it was hard for me to find guys my size, my weight, my athletic ability. I went from, you know, one gym to the next, and eventually became the biggest guy there. And even if, say, you know, a 135-pounder has better skills than you, but he's a 135-pounder,
yeah,
you can't, it's just not the same.
You know, and I think that's part of the reason why you get these super camps in MMA. You know what, yeah, I mean? Like, you never necessarily see that, like, in boxing or, you know, other combat sports. But MMA, it's almost kind of gravitated, you know, like a wrestling room. But now there's these giant super camps.
Well, that's the thing, though. You have to have training partners. And that's where MMA differs from boxing.
Yeah.
Like boxers can pay other boxers to come spar with them, you know, but they're just boxing, you know. For us, it's, well, I can't wrestle by myself.
Right.
You know, I can't do jiu-jitsu by myself. You know, I'm like, yeah, I could pay for sparring partners, but I need training partners. I need people to be able to get after it with me, not just spar with me. And so, you know, we need those other bodies around, and you need better bodies around. I mean, going down to Rain, where you've got guys like Mark Munoz in his prime was stupid to wrestle with. Pat Cummings, who's literally, I believe, stronger than a gorilla, is ludicrous to grapple with. And, you know, guys like Emmanuel Newton with his awkward, crazy striking, or even Brett Cooper, who's a phenomenally well-rounded guy. One of the guys that was huge in my development as a fighter was Jay Silva. Jay Silva's
right?
Got some of the heaviest
striking
hands, yeah. And it was because Jay, as a good training partner, we'd spar, and when we were done, then he talked to me. He would be like, okay, so you're doing this and you're doing this. Don't do that. That's terrible. Try not to do this. And, you know, I have a phenomenal boxing coach in Joseph Janik from Knuckleheads Boxing. Haas is amazing, you know, when it comes to technique and game planning. But there's only so much a coach can do for you. You really have to get in there and feel it. And when you have somebody that can communicate to you what you're doing on that, you know, right then. You know, there were times where, you know, I'd do something and Jay just stopped me and be like, no, that's bad. Don't do that. Or even if I did something good, you know, I'll never forget. I, you know, cracking him with a body shot one time and he was looking at me like, give me a minute. That was really good. Hold on. You know, I mean, it was, you know, that instant, like, you know, what did I do? Okay, I did it then. Okay, now I can try to repeat that. And so Jay was huge for me. Jay was one of the most instrumental people in my development early on at the Rain Training Center, just in my comfortability level with my own skills. It was letting me, his help helped me to unleash the skills that I had. And, but you know, that only comes because you have high level guys all in a room.
Yeah. And a way to build confidence of knowing that, you know, I'm competing with some of the best in the world, you know, in a training environment.
Yeah.
And I believe that will reflect out when I compete, yeah. You know what I mean? A lot of people don't realize, you know, when building a fighter, how much confidence in the mental game plays a part. You know what I mean? And I remember Donald Cerrone did this video on what his mindset is leading into a fight. I'm not sure if you ever saw it.
Was it the one where he said he's scared of shit?
It was, yeah, it was, yeah. Beautiful. He really broke down the whole day. Like if you've never been backstage of a USC going into a fight night, you know, you really can't explain it. But he did almost a perfect job to, like, you know, where your name is on the list, and you can kind of feel the countdown coming. you know, having that time limit warning from Bert, which, you know, unfortunately he's not doing that no more, but, you know, all the way to his thoughts, you know, right when he's about to head out the arena, you know, just having the self-doubt, mm-hmm. you know, thinking he's scared, thinking something, he's got to get it out of his head before he gets into that ring, you know, and then how the basically the switch kicks in for him right before the ref's going to say go. Like, yeah. he couldn't wait for it to get started fast enough. You know what I mean? And that, having that last moment there where he's like, let's go, let's get this started, that comes from extreme confidence. You know what I mean? I don't think you can make it to the top level, you know, in an individual sport like this without having that absolute belief in yourself that you're ready to perform. You know what I mean? How do you feel, like, you know, do you think Mark Munoz, who just had one of the most amazing retirement, you know, fights and speeches I've ever seen. I mean, that touched the whole MMA community. Do you think having a guy like that around really did, you know, wonders for your confidence in heading into a fight?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, Mark in general is just one of the best people I know.
You never hear anything bad about Mark.
Never. Because, I mean, there really isn't. He's just a very, very amazing man. You know, a great father, great training partner. I mean, everything he does is just out of this world, and he'll take on so much, you know, so much responsibility, so much of everything that he will take on, and he really gets behind everybody that he works with, and so you feel that, so then you give that back, and that was one of the beautiful things about the Reign Training Center, was that Mark brought the best out of everybody. I mean, while people were there, they did the right thing because he was there.
Wow.
You know, whether they were great people or not, and God knows we've all run into some phenomenal people and some shitheads, but when you were in the confines there, 99% of the time, everybody was doing the right thing, especially if Mark. When Mark was there, never a problem.
Never a problem.
Never a problem.
Never an issue with training partners. Nope. Never, nothing.
And now, I mean, you know, every gym has problems,
right.
You know, small conflicts, things like that. But when Mark was there, it's one of those things that you just never had the issue. You know, everybody kind of knew, dude, I'm kind of, you know, everybody would pull the thumb a little bit more.
Yeah.
And it's because he would be the first one. You know, he was just an amazing person and is an amazing person. And so, yeah, for me going down there, and especially when I went down there, I'll be honest, I was not at any of those guys' level. I was not ready. I was coming off the Ultimate Fighter, was not prepared for that.
You know? You were only like three fights into your career at all, right?
Yeah, three fights into my pro career. My hand, I was not comfortable striking at all. Now, combinations, throwing punches, moving, okay, but I hadn't quite really learned how to bring my game out. I hadn't really solidified what was going to be my game, how I was going to fight. And, but they still, you know, with Mark, and still, because he was fighting Yushin Okami, they needed a tall southpaw. I was like, oh, perfect. You know, that works out well. You can beat me up all you want to. And, you know, I was serviceable enough to give him what he needed in terms of striking. And so, but then it just, you know, as I kept going down there, then it was working with Jay, you know, then it was working with Emmanuel, working with Rafael Davis. I mean, so many of those guys were so instrumental in just grinding and learning. And, you know, you get that phenomenal balance of both, where you're grinding yourself, you know, to the nub, but you're building yourself back up because people are right there to tell you when you did something good. And, you know, mind check you if you think you're getting good. There's always somebody at the gym that's better than you at what you think you're good at.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, it was a beautiful thing. I mean, I would never have gotten near where I got if it wasn't for, you know, the people that I've worked with and the training partners that I've had.
You know, it is amazing to work with someone like that. I mean, when you have somebody who operates from a place of integrity, it does seem to carry through the room, you know, because people don't, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, if it's my 6-year-old daughter, it doesn't matter, you know, if it's a 20-year-old kid who just steps in MMA, you know, no one takes a lesson from you, you know, off a chalkboard, really. You know what I mean? No one will sit there and you sit down and with them and say, hey, if you do A, do this, you know, this is the way you act. This is the way, you know, everyone follows example.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so, you know, to get someone like that, you know, in MMA, you know, it doesn't happen all the time. It's very rare. You know what I mean? And,
well, you know, I find it amazing. I mean, cause you're always going to have personality clashes.
Oh yeah.
You know, but it's finding, cause you can have good people that just don't necessarily fit in a mold, you know, that just, you know, and that's why I think you see guys bounce from camp to camp. You know, eventually, you know, everybody's there, but then something happens where it's just like, I don't know if I can still be here. you know, and it's not that necessarily anybody was wrong, but it's just a feeling you get, and, you know, and then you find another gym, and hopefully, you know, that's a better fit for you. And we've got friends that just didn't quite fully enjoy, or didn't quite, you know, get the mode. And because people train differently too. Some people are grinders all the time.
Right.
You know, some people can take a step back and understand that, okay, it's time to learn. You know, but and there's, you know, there's always going to be different ways about it. There's no one right way. And so when you find those, it's, you know, it's just finding specifically what works for you, you know, and, you know, a lot of times you just have to get out there and you have to see, you know, what is out there.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a big proponent of try a lot of gyms, you know, but don't call a gym family if you're not going to be there.
Yeah.
You know, just be like, no, I'm, you know, hired gun, or, you know, I just came in to help, you know, I'm just here for this, you know, but if you find yourself in a position to go, man, I really feel like I could grow here, maybe that's a place for you.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, you see guys that, you know, they feel like sometimes maybe they've grown as much as they can at one gym. Okay, it happens, you know?
Yeah.
No feelings, go to another one.
Yeah, you've seen that a lot, you know. So you don't even really plan to have two contrast gyms. For the people who don't know, you train out of Knuckleheads gym in Ventura, mm-hmm. primarily, and then you also train out of Rain primarily, which, you know, Rain, former Rain now.
Yeah.
But, you know, Knuckleheads is a, you know, known for being a premier boxing gym.
Yeah.
You know, it's got guys, you know, like Victor Ortiz, you know, Chai Santana, you know, what have you. But, you know, that doesn't necessarily correlate for the best MMA gym. But in your case and a few other fighters, it really has.
Well, it's funny because with Knuckleheads, we've actually, almost every single one of our professional MMA fighters has been on The Ultimate Fighter, strangely.
Yeah.
It started with Jeremy Jackson on season 4. Then it was me on 11. Tony Ferguson, when he was mainly training out there, was with the winner of 14, I think. Jesse Newell was on tried out for 13 and lost to Diego Brandao to get on the show. He just happened to catch the guy that won it. Beals on 18. And I think we've only got two other guys that are fighting, and they just now hit the required minimum amount of fights to get on The Ultimate Fighter. So it almost feels like a matter of time. But, you know, with that, I mean, so many of us worked with Haas. I mean, and Haas is similar to a Mark Munoz for me in terms of just phenomenal people, and he gravitates to you. But his specialty was boxing. And then, you know, as he's kind of worked through his mixed martial arts career, now he's, you know, more kickboxing, you know, but he's very knowledgeable. And so he's very quick to game plan. And so we can really build off your specific skill sets. What are you good at? Okay, well, let's integrate that, you know, and he'll go learn more about that and, you know, see how we can integrate these things, you know, into the training. But at the same time, it's not a huge gym, and you need the jiu-jitsu. And that's why I was with Fabio Leopoldo, because I needed to learn to roll. And Fabio is my size, so it's a wonderful thing because I can get my ass handed to me by I believe he's a 4th-degree black belt now. Yeah. You know, he was a black belt before I knew what jiu-jitsu was, you know. And so it's one of those things where, and he's got amazing black belts. Professor Hernan, Professor Beto, Professor Klinger. I mean, all these guys are amazing. And, you know, Professor Klinger is the only smaller guy out of the group, but he'll still handle you. But the rest of them are all, you know, light heavyweights, in the jiu-jitsu game. So they're all my size. They're all bigger than me. So it was a beautiful thing that I can still go in there and get my butt handed to me by those guys. But,
you know, that's what's kind of crazy, is to find a gym with that many big guys for jiu-jitsu. I've never seen one.
Well, you know, it wasn't always the case. It wasn't until Fabio's schools really started taking off that he was able to bring those guys out. He just had Professor Hodger out from Brazil for a couple of months, which was an amazing role because his skill set was so much different than the other professors. But it was beautiful. You know, Professor Hernan is such a grinder. He's so strong. I mean, you get no room to breathe with Professor Hernan. Professor Beto's more open, more fluid, you know, but he catches you in things because you're, you know, in the scramble. You just can't stop it, and you can't lock him down into a position. Fabio is just all around, you know, wherever he wants to go, this is where. And he'll play a little bit more than others, you know, just because that he enjoys that game, you know, especially when I get to roll with him. So there's so many different levels of skill, even though they're all high levels. And it's just amazing. It's so much fun down there.
Do you feel that being that MMA is now, you know, it's a locked in sport now. I mean, the rules probably aren't going to change significantly for the foreseeable future.
Agreed.
So do you think now for, and this is my contention. My contention always was, you know, back in the day when, you know, you'd have Chuck Liddell and those guys were the champs, you know, they had significant losses. There'd be like 6 losses, 8 loss guys, you know, they'd be at the top of the game. And everyone would always say, well, that's because there's so many variables. My contention always was, it's because no one has ever, since they were born, trained in every single facet there was to the sport. Now, I said, this is my contention. My contention is that now, maybe starting now, you're going to get kids and have facilities and gyms that can, you know, fully equip them in every single part of the sport aspect of MMA. You'll be able to, like you say, start the no-gi grappling, you know, and functionality ways, you know, to shoot boxing, to takedowns, to, you know, mixing in strikes, punches, kicks. And now you actually will, going into the future, are going to get the Floyd Mayweather-like records. You're going to start seeing that.
I think it's, I'm not sure if we're there, but we're close. I mean, you're going to get guys, because guys are still at the point where, you know, Weidman, you know, is going to be able to dominate because of his wrestling, you know. But I think what it's going to take is it's going to take, you know, a generation of kids that not only learn it, but then can compete. You know, we're amateur MMA where they take 100 fights.
Oh, so you think...
I think it's going to take that skill level of taking all those fights. Because even right now, I mean, people take 5, 10 amateur fights and they're like, oh, I'm ready. I'm going to be a phenomenal pro.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And you still see a lot of ho-hum pros where you're like, oh, God, I can't believe... Dude, your skill level is terrible.
So, you're saying not only is it going to take the training and everything from a very young age, but you're going to need the amateur fights and the amateur system.
And that's when it's going to get... That's when it's going to get...
Amazing.
Because once you get the guys... I mean, even now, I mean, the most a fighter may have, you know, 50 fights, 60 fights. You know, or unless you're Jeremy Horn and you've got like 120 fish fights every weekend. But, you know, you get in there and... but I also, you know, I feel like... It's hard for MMA because we only have 3 rounds, 5 at the most, yeah. 5 minutes. So much happens in 5 minutes, and it's all so hard to score. You know, right. It's not like where you, in a boxing you can have a 10-8 round is really easy to score because that guy got dropped.
Yeah,
that happens all the time in MMA, and then the other guy gets dropped, and then you hit the ground. That guy dominated on the ground. That guy dominated on the feet. Whoa. Which one did you like more? You know, it's one of those things. I would actually be a huge proponent of shortening the rounds and extending the number of rounds.
Is that right? More like a boxing match.
I would love to have more like a boxing match. I think that would be fun. I think that would be more entertaining. I think because we're getting away from the boring, you know, slow ground and pound. Maybe I hold you on the ground. Maybe I'm doing these things like that. You know, and even the referees are getting more and more skilled at knowing what's happening on the ground. You can tell when, I mean, especially as a jiu-jitsu player, you can tell when somebody's just holding on.
Right.
You're like, dude, you can't do it. Get up. You can't do it. Get up. Advance your position. You know what I mean? Even on the top, because we're creating a aggressive, like we talked about earlier, aggressive jiu-jitsu system. So you can transition. You can set up these things and the referee can know what you're doing. Yeah. For so long, I mean, especially Big John has a command training for referees. And goes over a lot of specific technique in jiu-jitsu, so they get that base.
Yeah, I've just never heard that perspective from a jiu-jitsu fighter. What? Normally, I get the hey, we need a 10-minute first round.
Honestly, I don't like it. I don't like it because then you're cooking. Then it's it gives you time to okay, we're gonna set this up. I want to see a finish and a scramble.
So you don't feel like primarily being a jiu-jitsu fighter, you don't feel like. Damn it, now the round ended and now it's like we're starting all over again. It's like a new fight.
But I like that. Wow. To me, finish fast. Get after it. Move. Don't sit in half guard hoping to get a punch every 20 seconds.
That's incredible.
Throw some elbows, elbow his legs, elbow his body, elbow his face. Move. Work to pass. Work to go. You know, I feel like, you know, I mean, and it's getting away from traditional jiu-jitsu, but I think that makes for a very entertaining aspect of the sport.
You think it makes for a better sport?
Yeah. And two, it'll give guys, I mean, one, rounds would be much easier to judge, in my opinion. I think you'd have a much, you know, you'd have, you know, because how many rounds have you watched a guy dominate for 3.5 minutes, then 30 minutes of nothing, And then the other guy gets maybe a couple of good shots off on the feet in the last 30 seconds and he wins the round.
Yeah, he clips him.
And
yeah.
you're like, shorten the round. Make everybody be a bit more aggressive. You know, I think it would make for an interesting fight.
Yeah, that would be incredible. Oh, man, I can't believe this, but we're out of time. We should have made this a 2-hour podcast.
That happened quickly.
Yeah, you shouldn't have had all your obligations a day to go to.
You got diapers to drop off at baby showers and such. It's funny, though. I get to drop off diapers to a guy that choked me out one time.
Right? Is that right? You lost the fight to him.
I lost the fight to Latif. He's Latif Python. He's got this giant python he brings, and not just his python, but a python that he'll bring into the ring after he wins. Yeah, hit me with a straight right hand. It was it was an amateur fight back in 2007. Oh, it was a blast. We had a good time.
That's amazing, man. It's like Jake the Snake Roberts.
Basically, yeah.
Does he put it over your body after you're unconscious?
No, luckily, he lets you move, and then he throws it in the middle of the ring.
All right, man. Well, we're going to go ahead and wrap this up. I hope you guys enjoy the first edition of the Drum Technique. Please subscribe to us on YouTube, iTunes, Stitcher. I don't know where else we're going to be, but hopefully we have all those. We also got a Facebook account. Joe, it's been a pleasure of always talking to you. It's great to get a guy like you who's, very well educated, very well spoken, still doing mixed martial arts. You know, I have no idea how a guy like you got into it. You know, it doesn't happen very often, but we do appreciate your time.
Oh, no, thank you for having me. I had a blast.
Yeah, and please subscribe, and we should be doing these shows much more regularly. Look for episode 2 with Hidon Gracie, probably coming at you this Monday at 2:30. So thank you very much. See you next time.
Drum Technique.
You ready?
Drum Technique. Drum Technique.